Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, and I'm so delighted you're joining me today because we're going to be talking about a subject matter that means a lot to me, though I'm not personally involved with it, and that is search and rescue with dogs. My guest today, Susan Purvis, she is a woman that has walked a journey that not many women, or men for that matter, are going to stand up and say, oh, here, take me. I would just love to do this. Why? Because search and rescue demands tremendous training, tremendous discipline. It's almost like going through Navy SEAL stuff, but maybe not quite as bad. But that might be something that someone would discuss with me. Susan Purvis, I want to welcome you to the show. Your book, Go Find Your Journey to Find the Lost and Yourself, is apparently number one on Amazon. It's just been shooting up. People are absolutely in love with this book, and I can totally understand why. I'm so delighted that you're able to join me from Montana today.
Hello. I'm so happy to speak with you.
We got acquainted a tiny bit at a book show that was going on here in Tacoma. When I received your material last fall, I said, whoa, I definitely want to talk about this because search and rescue is so absolutely dangerous, number one. Number two, the lives of people just hang on a thread, especially if you're in avalanche country, well, anywhere in the wild. And number three, to have a team partner like Tasha, and you go into how you adopted her, but your story about getting involved in this, to me, was just amazing. It's like a hand bigger than yours said, this is where you needed to be. But it wasn't an easy journey, was it?
It was not an easy journey, and I'd like to say, also, I jumped into the search and rescue career kind of blindfolded and really naive. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, nor did I realize how hard or difficult it would be, not only to learn myself, but then to train a dog.
Mm-hmm. It's really a challenge. You were married. You go into your book, you describe how you met the man that you felt was the love of your life, Doug. But you were in South America hunting for gold. You've got to tell my audience how you go from the tropics to the freezing cold.
Yeah, I like to say my life before Tasha and my life before search and rescue is I was an exploration geologist looking for gold in Latin America, specifically the Dominican Republic. So that's what I got a degree in, and I married a geologist, and he was the Caribbean expert, and so we were looking for gold. But I sat there lonely. I knew that I didn't care about money. I didn't really care about looking for gold. I loved the people and the natives and, you know, living in El Campo. But something was missing in my life, and I didn't know what it was. And so I decided one winter to take some time off, and I got on ski patrol school at the last great Colorado ski town at 9,500 feet. And I heard about an avalanche that buried three toddlers across the street from this world-class ski resort.
Whoa.
And that's what we call in book writing an inciting incident. And that, after listening to that story, my life changed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you and your husband had decided that you didn't want children. What was the urge that made you decide to go and get a puppy? Because when you have puppies, it's just the same as having children. They just grow up faster, hopefully.
I know. So I don't know. I've always wanted a dog, but I never had the lifestyle because we constantly commuted. And I thought, wow, you know, if I'm not going to have kids, maybe I need a companion. And, you know, what would my life be like with the dog? And I, you know, it was one way also to get out of this grind of working in the jungle. And I really wanted my life to be in the snow, but I didn't really have a career in the snow. I didn't know how I could possibly make a living in Colorado, but my puppy was the impetus to make change. So let me tell you, do you want to hear about the story that I heard while I was on ski patrol school?
Sure.
Yeah, so I was, it was a 100-inch storm all week long, and I was learning how to be a ski patroller, and the patrol team told me that across the street, an avalanche came down on a hill above a condominium complex that buried three little toddlers. They were 4, 4, and 6 years old on a Sunday morning at 9 a.m., and they were waiting for a shuttle bus to bring them back to Houston, Texas, where they lived. And the dad was outside loading the shuttle bus with luggage when he looked up and he heard a crack, and then he looked up and a wall of snow came down and buried these three little kids.
Mm.
And I went, oh, my God. And so everybody, you know, the entire town responded, scrambling, trying to find these little kids. And the ski patroller said, well, they deployed their avalanche dog. And I said, well, what does a dog do? Really? You know, dogs can find people in the snow. I was so fascinated. And I said, well, did the dog find the kids? And he said, no. And I'm like, what do you mean the dog didn't find the kids? Isn't that the dog's only job? And their answer they gave me when I kept pursuing it wasn't good enough. They couldn't answer why the dog couldn't find the kids. And it was at that moment after, during the storm, I walked up that hill. Nothing had changed. There was no signs warning the public that this hillside could slide and kill people. And I thought, what if I trained a dog to save a life? And I vowed at that moment to never leave anyone behind.
You adopt this little puppy. You find, because he didn't have a lot of experience with dogs, this baby has a mind of its own. But you fell in love with each other from the very moment you met her. And
yes.
Then you started training. One of the factors that I absolutely loved about your book is your candor about being a petite woman. You're 5'3". You didn't have a feeling of what I want to call strength about yourself. You hated conflict of any type. And when I was reading this, I thought, oh my word, this is like a segment of me that I'm reading about from your perspective. And this candor, when you were writing your book, was this really a challenge for you to talk about?
Oh, yeah. Also, you know, my analogy to writing this book was no different than training a dog. I mean, I went out and said, I'm going to train the best possible dog. And then one day I woke up and said, I'm going to write a book about my adventures with my dog. And I didn't know how to write. I didn't know anything about story structure. And I had to go, like my dog training, go surround myself with writers. I had to study the craft and be fluent so I could write my story. And I wanted my story to be good. It took me 10 years. Kind of like the fluency in dog training, it takes a career, a lifetime, to get your dog and yourself up to speed and be really good at your craft. And what I learned is that, you know, the dog's life is limited. You know, we only have a short window.
Mm-hmm.
We put all this time and effort into it, and we create this bond, and then, poof, they're gone.
That's true. That is very true. And that's what's so heartbreaking for so many people, because dependent on the breed of the dog, but they become a part of you. They become, they're just like children. They are so significant in your life that your minds blend. It's like a mind melding occurs with a dog. At least that's been in my experience. Yours, most definitely. You become like one unit. And here you are in training. I adored the poodle lady.
The poodle lady.
Yes.
I love her still.
But I love the poodle too, because you got a photo. You've got beautiful photos in here.
Yeah.
And the photo of the poodle lady is just absolutely phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal, because with her and her dog and the wind's blowing the dog's hair. Now, she was very specific, but you had to go through multiple levels of training. And you've got a puppy. They want to play. They don't want to be disciplined. And that was something you had to learn to do because your dog grew up from this adorable little, you know, 8-week-old something that you could hold so gently in your hand to, what was it, 80, 90, 100-pound dog? How heavy did she get?
No, she was between 55 and 60 pounds, which was ideal for me because any dog bigger than that I wouldn't be able to lift. Half the battle with dog training is getting them to places, getting them on snowmobiles, loading them in helicopters, putting them on escalators. All that stuff is requires a lot of finesse, and you don't want your dog to get hurt. But I tell you what, I used to kind of, what happened, I think, in my life, I was alpha in my life, and then I met my husband, and I became submissive.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which is a really interesting thing. I've been talking to a lot of people about this, is that sometimes we fall into these roles, and then I became a little submissive in my dog training because I always thought if my dog loved me, she'd do anything I said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that wasn't the case. I ended up tackling her half the time because she had a different agenda than I did, and her agenda was eating food, finding food.
Mm-hmm.
She was really good at that.
Yes. Now, your dog, Tasha, she really had a knack for following scents, and you had to go through various aspects of training with her, and you even went in for wilderness medical training. But the beginning, when working with her as a puppy, dogs mature fairly quickly, but it's about 2 years before they start getting into more of a mature patterning. What kind of training did you have with her from the time you started with her as a puppy? What did you find was necessary?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, standard operating procedures. The problem I had is I lived in Crested Butte, Colorado, and I had no mentors nearby. The closest mentor I had was 3 to 5 hours away. So the one thing I decided when I got a dog was I'm going to stay home and be domestic and, you know, not travel because I'd been traveling my whole life. And then all I did when I got my dog was to travel to learn how to train with, you know, to learn the craft of how do you train a search dog. And so my first mentor was Poodle Lady in Aspen, and her dog was a poodle, and the poodle did everything she asked of. Tasha was the opposite. I had to tackle her and, you know, force her to do stuff, and she's like, no, I'm not doing that. And so it was like yin and yang, back and forth, this and that. And so by the time my dog was 2, I had a kind of a mess because I didn't have the standard operating procedure. I never took her to obedience class. I should have been in obedience class with her, but my reality was, we'll figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of ways to skin a cat. The end result was I had, you know, a really good search dog because I gave her the freedom to make choices. And, there's no right or wrong. It's just how we did it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you went through a lot of stress because of this. You wanted to really get her into the search and rescue, and SARDOC, that is an abbreviation for Search and Rescue Dogs of Colorado. What are the requirements for a search dog to be accepted as part of this organization?
Yeah, one of the best things I ever did was join this nonprofit organization in Colorado, and their job is to train and be a deployment agency for law enforcement agencies. So I followed their really strict standards. They have some of the strictest standards in the nation, and I had to follow every rule and pass every test, and I couldn't deploy my dog until I dotted all my I's and crossed all my T's. So I suffered a lot because I would have to travel and I'd go drive 7 hours and I'd fail a test and I'd have to come back all the way home, and then maybe 3 or 4 months later I could retest. So they wanted really good dogs because law enforcement and the family depended on it. Mm-hmm. And I'm really proud that I took that route, because I could have just stayed in my little town and said, I have an avalanche or a search and rescue dog. And, you know, I could have missed a human being, and, you know, and they could have died out there. So I didn't want that to happen. So I stuck to some really high standards.
Mm-hmm. Which was a good thing.
It's a really good thing.
Yes. When people are involved in search and rescue, I'm in the state of Washington. We have Mount Rainier. It is very unusual to not hear a story about search and rescue, because so many times when people go out, even if they're very skilled and experienced, they can be engaged in situations. When you started this, there were no cell phones. People did not have the electronic gadgets like the finder units that you could trace and all of this. They didn't have that at the time you started. You had radio units, and you said half the time they didn't even work well in the mountains.
Yeah.
So you had to be well-versed. You had to have a sense of direction. You said when you were young, your dad taught you how to use a map and how to use a compass. And very few people today do that. Do they still have that in the training?
Well, I think that's everybody's biggest weakness is navigation. And, you know, that's something I was really good at, because as a geologist, we always had to know where we were. I tell you what, most people don't know how to navigate. I just got back from a sailing trip in the Bahamas, and all I did was look at the map. I needed to know where I was, and my friends were looking at me going, wow, like, take it easy. You know, we have electronics to show us where we are. And I'm like, oh, that's not how I roll.
Mm-hmm.
So, and by the way, the Seattle area has a really strong dog program, because you read in my book, I ended up going to cadaver dog boot camp, where I learned how to, you know, find human remains, because the hard reality of the search and rescue dog career is that most people we find are not alive, and we end up finding, you know, I like to call ourselves the cleanup crew. We find mm-hmm. bodies. And so I got a chance to really interact with the dog teams from the Pacific Northwest, and I got to train with a lot of the dog teams at the ski resorts near Seattle, which was really a privilege and an honor as well.
Dogs have an incredible ability to sniff anything from cancer to bombs. And I know in the military, those men and women that train with the dogs, that follow them overseas, give them, I mean, they just love these animals, and they hate to leave them behind. And fortunately, many of them they're able to bring home today. That wasn't always the case. But there's a lot of training that goes into that. And there has to be a very good bond between the trainer and the animal. And this is something that I don't think many people are able to recognize, understanding that there's a language that occurs between a trainer and a dog. And you had to learn Tasha's language, didn't you?
Yeah, that was really interesting, because I went into this thinking, oh, you know, if my dog loves me, she'll do what I say. But, you know, dogs don't think like humans. And so I had to, at some point, when in all my frustration, have to say, what is it my dog needs, and why isn't she listening to me, and what is that language of love and partnership and discipline, kind of like a, you know, a newborn and a parent? There's mm-hmm. no manual on how you understand this little creature that comes to your life. And, you know, by trial and error and finding mentors, I learned how to communicate what exactly I needed my dog to do. And it took, you know, 3 to 5 years become fluent.
Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, something that very few people really, really get unless they have the opportunity to go through the training. So in a sense, you were being trained by your dog, and yet you had to train your dog so that you could follow certain protocols. Once she got it, she was happy with it, wasn't she?
Yeah, so they had an epiphany, you know, 3/4 of the way into my book, is that, she's the trainer and I'm the trainee. And this, you know, the equalness And the, you know, I wasn't alpha all the time. She had things to teach me as well. And I'm, you know, grateful for that.
Oh, very, very much so. Your first medical mission on a ski control, what was that like for you?
Well, when I was on ski patrol, yes. I was on a really steep part of the mountain, and, you know, for weeks, I wasn't getting called to respond to the mission because they wanted all the veterans to take care of the medical problems. And I'm like, but I work at a ski clinic. I'm really good at this. I went into it all in confidence, and I went onto the head wall. And I was looking for this woman who basically pinned down this, you know, 45-degree slope and found herself stuck in the trees full of blood, all mangled up. And I was the first on scene, and everything I learned about emergency medicine went right out the window because I freaked out. I could not control my crazy mind, and I did everything wrong. The first thing you're supposed to do is protect yourself, put your gloves on. I went and grabbed her head. I didn't have my gloves on. And then I realized I was all full of blood, and I wasn't really doing anything very well. And humiliation is, I guess, my biggest teacher in all of this. So I'll tell you what, once it happens to you once, you'll never do it again.
Mm-hmm. I think that you've made a comment that is very, very important, and that is we're all going to experience failure. Now, this woman ended up being rescued, and there was another man with you at that time that actually had gotten to the scene before you did, but he didn't try to do anything extra because he said, we're going to need a lot more people to get this woman out of this precarious situation. So you cannot, you can intellectualize till the cows come home, but until you got your feet on the ground and your hands are dirty and your guts are raw, you don't know what it is. You cannot know. You just cannot. So
you cannot. Same with a mission, right? Like the first time you go to your first mission, you're like, oh my God, you know, how do I do this?
Mm-hmm.
What if my dog does, you know, fails? Well, you know, then I'm a failure. All these things go through your mind. And, you know, one of the things that's really important with dog work is we have to keep going into the field. We need experience if we're going to be good. And it's just a lot of competition to keep us away from being in the field as a dog team.
Mm-hmm. Also, you go into the training that you got on how to feed your dog. And I was really intrigued with this because you went to a special training, and the guy that was training you said you've got to feed your animal like you feed yourself, and that animals in the wild, the wolf will eat the guts of an animal first. And the reason is that that's where all the digested grasses and grains are. And you have to make sure that the first four ingredients in dog food are real food, and whatever you do, not to buy the dog food that has the word meal in it because it's poison. I read that and I went, whoa.
You read my book cover to cover. I'm so proud of you.
Well, thank you very much, madam. This material is excellent. I mean, just that little portion. Now, my Scotties, and those little terriers, I cooked their food. Their digestive tracts could not handle canned food, and they hated kibble.
Yeah. We should technically be giving our dogs raw food, raw meat, and we should be cooking for them. Because if we want to live this healthy, long, beautiful life, they need to be eating really well. Yeah. So good for you. Everybody I meet, I tell them, you know, when I see them pour, like, the Purina dog chow into their bowl, I just go, oh, my God. You know, that's like us eating McDonald's hamburgers for, you know, weeks, months, or years. Something's got to give eventually. So all your listeners out there, you know, feed your dog well. You can start reading about it. There's some great books and manuals and magazine articles about, you know, nutrition for canines.
Oh, yes. It's so important. Also, you encountered a gentleman that ran a 150,000-acre ranch. And his statement to me was so profound. Now, this is a person, obviously, that lives out where everything is wild. He's raising bison. He's got dogs. He is really connected with them. And I loved the description that he gave. He said, there's a fine dance between me, my dogs, and a herd of bison. The bison will move. They'll go wherever you want them to go with ease, as long as you don't put too much pressure on them. And it is a dance with a dog. It really, with any living creature. But it takes time. You spent hours in training, and your marriage, your husband was often gone. He was out and about and doing different things. Here you are doing what you're doing. But what I found so intriguing is that the action going on in the relationship with your dog really was bringing to the forefront a lot of things that you weren't facing in your own marriage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm so glad I met that man, actually. And that was just a couple years ago. And so at the very end of my book, I was able to put that in. But he taught me that, you know, we go through life either alpha or submissive. And, you know, everybody's got an agenda. My agenda was to, you know, make my dog a really good search and rescue team. And to find humans and to never leave anyone behind. But my dog's like, wait a minute, maybe my agenda is something different. So I was shoving this agenda down on my dog. My husband had his agenda on me. And, you know, we do this dance in life. And, you know, unless we are able to communicate what we're trying to do, things start to fall apart because there's a resistance. It's uh-huh. like the standing bison. They're like, wait a minute, I'm not doing what you're telling me to do. And I help people now because a lot of people have been calling me and reaching out and saying, oh, my God, your book has, you know, helped me with my relationship. Or some friends say, oh, Sue P., now my wife wants to talk about our relationship, you know.
Uh-huh.
So having that open discussion about everything we do is really important. It keeps the relationship healthy. So how do you do that with a dog, right?
Uh-huh. It is amazing.
And watch them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, your book has so much in it. It is so rich. Once somebody starts reading this, they're not going to be able to put it down. And the awareness and the expression of information that you give regarding Tasha and yourself, your relationship, how your then-husband Doug, what his relationship was with the dog, you're growing into really who you are, and the dog is sort of the catalyst for this, but the dog is enjoying the journey for most part. What I find is important also is that you received a recognition on Congressional Record from the House of mm-hmm. Representatives. And the Honorable Scott McInnes of Colorado, and this was dated June 19th, 2003, giving tribute to you and Tasha, who were very much involved in search and rescue, locating victims of avalanches, and I'm paraphrasing this a little bit. And it was during March of the year 2003, correct me if I'm wrong,
mm-hmm.
that there were two avalanches that hit, and the first trapped a 33-year-old man, and 30 rescuers had been looking for him for hours, and they finally called you in, and they found the body because of Tasha within a half an hour. And then you also got a call a few days later regarding a snowmobiler. The snowmobiler actually triggered the avalanche. The slide was 10 feet deep, several hundred feet wide, and the debris field was 20 feet deep, had snow and ice the size of a van in it. You found this man's body 6 feet of snow later. The survival factor of people, this is why dogs are so valuable. The survival factor is a very short period of time, isn't it?
Oh, yes. You don't have long to live once you're buried under snow. And, you know, so one of the big messages I wanted, and one of the reasons why I wrote this book, is that I wanted the public to know that when somebody you know goes missing, whether they're lost in the woods, in the water, you know, because dogs find people in the water, buried in an avalanche, call a dog team and insist on it and call a really good dog team, because we're quick, fast, and efficient, and we save, you know, tax dollars, and because we're really good at what we do. And sometimes we don't get called to, you know, for days, weeks, or months later, and there's something needs to change with that.
Mm-hmm. Now,
yeah,
you have your own organization, the Crested Butte Outdoors International. Now, you have been in Nepal. You have been in different places throughout the United States. This is something that you're engaged in. What does your business do?
Thanks for asking. So over 20 years ago, I started my company, Crested Butte Outdoors. So I became a, you know, I loved medicine. I became a wilderness medicine expert. So I teach wilderness medicine courses and avalanche courses around the world. And so, like, I'm going right, you know, I'm going back to teach Ted Turner's ranchers about wilderness medicine. And, you know, so I teach everybody from housewives to Secret Service to the FBI to flight medics and how to manage people when you're out in the middle of nowhere and there is no 911. You are 911.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives me great joy. It's how I make my living. And now I, in Montana, I'm teaching avalanche courses, which, you know, combines, you know, really I'm teaching people how to make decisions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when, you know, there is no help coming.
Well, I think that that is amazing. Now, I know that your dog died from a brain tumor, and this is something that is heartbreaking. I know, because I had a little Scotty that died from seizures and a brain tumor. What would you say to anybody that would want to get into this line of work, that would really love to be a part of search and rescue?
Great question. I just got a call yesterday from a woman actually in Canada, and she's like, what kind of dog do I get? Who should I contact? How do I become an avalanche dog handler? And all I said was, buy the dog that you want to live with. But if you're going to work in avalanche, get maybe an oily dog, because some dogs have really fine hair and they get all balled up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go surround yourself with mentors. So I put her in touch with like five people I knew kind of in the Seattle area and in Canada. And I said, your training starts now. You know, you need to get up to speed. You have to learn about medicine. You need to know how to navigate. You need to learn how to ski if you're going to do all this stuff. But search and rescue teams are all volunteer. And there's people in those organizations that help you, you know, learn these skills.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, Susan.
Tasha.
Mm-hmm. Susan, you have... Oh, excuse me. We're talking over each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. You are doing something incredible with your work. And more than anything else, you bring home very vividly the reality that discipline, education, and feet on the ground, practical experience is absolutely first and foremost with this. And of course, you live this every day now, and you have for years. I think your story, Go Find, is absolutely incredible. There is a website. People can go to your website, susanpurvis.com. And, Susan, it's just been a delight having you as a guest today. And your book is a real gripper because you bring out the facts. And you've done an incredible job with it. And congratulations on your success.
Thank you.
Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Check out susanpurvis.com. Believe me, once you start reading this, you're not going to want to put it down.
You're listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you'd like to have an opportunity to be featured on this program or Warriors for Peace heard Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, please send a copy of your publication along with your contact information to The Donna Sebo Show, Post Office Box 97272, Lakewood, Washington 98497. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review of the publication. Again, the mailing address is Post Office Box 97272, Lakewood, Washington 98497. Children's literacy is a passion for award-winning author-publisher Donna Sebo. Mrs. Sebo's Classics is now participating in a GoFundMe project to assist in the publishing of first-quality illustrated children's publications that will inspire children of all ages around the world. We invite you to join us in this campaign by visiting www.gofundme.com/Mrs. Sebo's Classics. You'll see more about the campaign's message and the bonus gifts of appreciation Donna is offering to those of you who desire to participate. You can also find out more information by going to her website, www.delphiinternational.com. With your support, the impossible becomes possible. She'll be able to reach the hearts, minds, and spirits of children everywhere, empowering them to reach for a better future. Thank you.
Donna Sebo here. The telephone line is open if you want to give me a call. 253-582-5597. Now, my guest tomorrow is going to be discussing Atlantis in the Caribbean. We're going to be talking about Vincent van Gogh, how a doctor, Dr. Irv Ehrenberg, believes that Vincent van Gogh was murdered. Well, we'll find out more about that. Miracle stem cell treatment for the heart. And otherwise, I think we have got a great lineup. I invite you to share the programming with your friends. And if you want to be kept informed about who is coming up on the Donna Sebo Show, then what you need to do is sign up for the newsletter. Go to my website, DelphiInternational.com or Mrs. Sebo's Classics.com, where you will be getting a pop-up menu. Put your information in there, and the first of every month, you will receive a newsletter from me. Also, what I want you to know is that if you like us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, also click that follow button. My assistant, Deb, will keep you informed about what happens when we have guests on the show, where I'm speaking, and relative to that, I'm going to be at the Psychic Spectrum in Fife, Washington. I'm the keynote speaker at 6 p.m. on Wednesday evening. And I will be doing demonstrations as well. Also, with that information, she keeps you up to date. Sometimes we have guests where storms come in, phone lines go out, we reschedule them. Again, you'll be kept informed relative to that. Let's see if we have a caller on the line. Hi, this is Donna. Are you calling into the show?
Yes, I am.
First name or initial, please, and where are you calling in from?
Letter L from UP.
Where, UP in Washington?
Yes.
Okay. All right, Elle, the very first thing that I'm getting with you is that you are going to need to really have what I call a calendar of to-do. Now, you make lists all the time. That's not the issue. But what I'm looking at are like blocks. And you need to organize your perspectives, and you need to really have some time by yourself where you can sit down with a pad of paper and really look at where your focus needs to be. Now, the reason this is so important is that in the first quarter of this year, you're going to have so many interruptions. You're going to have so many distractions that if you do not keep yourself oriented towards what you really need to have as your top three priorities. I'll just make it sort of simple in that respect. You need to keep those priorities right in front of you and then say no to what does not fit in there. You don't need to take on or try to be Superwoman. You've, these next 3 to 5 years, you are developing a side of yourself that you have yearned to do. You have wanted to really be able to make, give the time and the commitment. There's a part of you that says, gee, is it something I really should be doing? There's all kinds of questions. This is normal. But when you really get down to the bare bones and guts of what means the most to you, you need to really have integrity with yourself and keep your focus where it's supposed to be. Regardless of who might whine, complain, and even you might whine and complain every once in a while. But you need to keep your eye on the goal. It's like an Olympic swimmer. You know that you have to get from one side of the pool to the other side of the pool, and you got a clock ticking, and if you worry about everybody else that you're racing against in the pool, then you don't have a chance of winning because you're too preoccupied. But if you focus really on what you need to do, stay in your lane, if you will, keep that image in front of you saying, I'm really focusing on this, you're going to beat the clock. And that is very important. Now, I said 3 to 5 years.
Uh-huh.
You may hear that and you may go, you've got to be kidding me. Three to five years? Give me a break, lady. I don't need that. Do you know how long that sounds? All you do is take one day at a time. That's all you do. You've got to keep the objective in front of you. For you to really excel the way you want to excel, you're not unlike my guest. You have to put yourself where you know you are going to have that demonstration and those examples. There's no shortcuts. It doesn't happen. It doesn't work. And that's what you have to keep in mind. And I think part of your distraction, wherever it is or whatever it is you're trying to focus on, is that there may be people that tell you there are shortcuts. Uh-uh. You have to pay your dues. And that's what it's going to take. And believe me, by the time you refine whatever it is you need, number one, you're going to develop excellent alliances. Number two, you're going to find yourself in the company of people that are going to stand behind you whenever you need support. So stay focused. This first quarter is really the beginning of a journey that is going to reward you handsomely if you'll stay focused. What question do you have for me today?
You know, everything that you talked about kind of rotates, I'm assuming, around my business and what I'm trying to do as an entrepreneur. So I guess my question goes back to that, and it's a lot of the times I feel like I'm not sure what direction or if I'm doing the right thing.
What kind of work are you doing? What kind of business do you have?
I have a photography business. It's all glamour. I have no other style of photography. I don't do weddings or babies. And then I do a certain type of airbrush makeup and, you know, digital editing. And I have a magazine and a book that I want to put out. So I have some opportunities to put that out. And I'm wondering if I should keep going with those projects. I'm using them as a tool to showcase. So it's like I'm doing all these things like videos as well as the magazine to try and showcase my work to hit the masses to get more known, because I keep thinking that's how I'm going to get more exposure or book more sessions. And I'm, you know, and then I think, gosh, should I just do something else?
No, I think you are really in an environment that you like. You like the diversity. You like the challenges that come your way. I think when it comes to the book and the publishing of the magazine, that's sort of overkill. What okay. I would do is break it down. Remember in the beginning I said break it down into boxes? You need to compartmentalize each of these aspects. You need to look at, let's say, the magazine and the book. You need to look at that as a separate entity. You need to look at your photography work as a separate entity. You need to look at the airbrushing that you do as a separate entity. And then you want to have more exposure because you're wanting to increase your income. So you need to have an awareness of what is going to bring you the income that you need. Your magazine, you may want to delegate out to someone else. I would say if you were going to do a magazine, maybe do it once every 6 months.
Or, that's exactly what I'm doing. Yeah,
so once every 6 months, that's what you do. Look at how you need to be able to think about that independently. Now, that magazine is not necessarily going to bring you a whole bunch of business. So you need to look at where you want to focus your priority and ask yourself the very hard question, how can you refine that which is going to be most economically rewarding? And how do you reach that niche? For example, if you were a nature photographer and you really wanted to reach the environment that your photography was, maybe you just absolutely loved whales. That was it. Just absolutely loved whales. Okay, you focus on the whales. You can bring other things in, but you design your own niche.
Well,
and that's going to work.
I'm focusing on doing these videos, these hair and makeup and photography videos, to a certain niche. So I was hoping that would help me really take off. So I've been committing to that twice a week and making sure those get done on a regular schedule.
Well, that's not a bad idea. See, your choice. I just was giving you some examples. You need to really look. You need to sit down with yourself and look at it. Because it's, when we're in business, when we're an entrepreneur, we typically are able to do more than one thing. But we have to ask ourselves, where is my strength? Where is my greatest strength? And if it is working with the makeup, then that's what you focus on. And anything and everything else then comes in step number two, step number three, step number four. So you need to really get that kind of razor focus. And as women, and I'm guilty of this. This is why I can say it with such enthusiasm. We have a tendency to think we can do all and be all, just like the old song where the gal's burping the baby, frying the eggs, hanging the laundry, and doing all this kind of stuff. I've got to find out the title of that song. I've never forgotten it, but I don't remember all the lyrics. That is absolutely ridiculous. Men have a much better perspective. Not that flexibility doesn't have its advantage. But we often get so, as women, we get so scattered that we just burn ourselves out. Men have the attitude, and a lot of it is the indoctrination. They just want to focus on something, and they give it 100% in general. And that is, it's we think differently. But we can learn from the men how to focus, and then we can then fold in the other components.
Well, I think as an artist too, it's like challenging because you want to make that income, but it doesn't come right away. So that's my other question is like, do I get another job? Is there a job on the horizon? Because nothing has happened to me. And so the business just keeps going. But
well,
it's
the business,
up and down.
Yeah, of course, it's going to go up and down. If you feel like you need to have a second job, ask yourself, if you go and look for a job, what's going to dovetail with what you're doing? In other words, seek out something. If you feel like you need to make sure that you have a stable income, seek out a part-time job that maybe is in the, you know, makeup industry or something else. Just say, I'm going to put myself into a working environment where maybe I'll find some new mentors that can teach me what I need to know. You're into photography. You're into the video work. Find out about a place where you could work part-time. That'd fill your gas tank and do whatever else you need to do. And then you'll develop maybe some mentors along the way. The choice is yours. This is not going to be an easy thing. It is not going to be easy. I would be lying to you if I said, oh, there's going to be a magic fairy coming along with a purple dress and green eyelashes. It's just going to fix your life. I'm sorry. If you see somebody like that, pick up your money and run. Seriously, you need to know this is a long-term project. This isn't short-term, hon. It's long term. So don't give up on the dream. Just realize you're making a choice. You're making an investment. And this is going to take time.
Okay.
And I want to thank you for calling. By the way, I'm going to be speaking at the Poodle Dog in Fife, Washington this coming Wednesday.
Okay.
So I'll be there at 6 in the evening. And if you happen to come out, bring some friends. We have a great time.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Blessings and Happy New Year to you. This is going to be a dynamic one for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. I'll be back with you shortly. Don't go away. By the way, I have a recipe for dogs, especially young puppies. Remember what my guest said? You got to train the puppies. Mm-hmm. Well, this is something that they are going to enjoy.
Warriors for Peace is a weekly broadcast hosted by Donna Sebo. Leaders from all walks of life and professions from around the world, including those who have served to protect one of our most priceless gifts of life, freedom, speak to the issues of the day. Join us Wednesdays, 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time.
Building a nation. What do you think that takes? What do you feel we need to do? Well, Building a Nation is quite a powerful book. Heather Gray is going to be my guest, and we will be hearing from her what she's observed and what has happened in different parts of the world when it comes to building a nation. Fascinating topic. And don't forget, you can be kept informed by my assistant, Deb, when you like us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. And, oh, if you are aware of something very special that you feel might be of interest to my listeners, all you need to do is send me an email. You can go to my website, DelphiInternational.com, and through the contact portion, you will be able to send me a message, and that's the best way for me to get your information. And this is something where people often in subject lines, they won't put information in there. I get hundreds of emails on a daily basis. If you want me to pay attention to your email, then you need to put interview or radio show, the Donna Sebo show, or Warriors for Peace show, and then put something behind it so that I know that this is something you're submitting. Believe me, I have hundreds of emails daily, and I would say a good 95% of them end up being deleted because someone just assumes that they're going to be read. That's not the case. I don't have time for that. I've got too many other things on my plate, so make sure if you send an email, go through my website, and then I will get back to you as quickly as I'm able to. My guest today, Susan Purvis, she had her lab, and that lab ended up just doing incredible rescue work. Well, when you have a puppy, usually they're food motivated. Now, some dogs aren't. I had a Scottish Terrier that wasn't. Well, one of my previous guests, Frederica Friedel, she loved labs, and she put out a cookbook for dogs, because as my guest said, you have to pay attention to the nutrition you give your animal, and kibble is not necessarily the best thing to do. Well, Frederica said that she developed these recipes because she found that the puppies, and she had labs, and labs can get to be a pretty good size, but she said to keep them trim so that they don't get fat, and they love their food. They just love their food. She said, when you've got a puppy, you want to be able to train them. And they're very active dogs. They're very active dogs. They're not couch potatoes unless they're, you know, allowed to get that way. And she said, one of the things that she learned in having dogs is that coming on command is very difficult for most dogs. But almost all dog breeds love hunting and seek and find games. So she said when you'd combine them, it just is great. It keeps them active. And if you're in a place where it's snowy and really bad weather, you have to keep your dog inside. Well, you want to be very, very wise. Now, what if you're out on a walk and your dog is not on a leash? If you initiate an interesting seek and find game, when your dog needs to be summoned. She said, you need to train them so that they will come when they're called. She said, place a tasty morsel on the ground close to your feet. Call the dog and let the dog search for and eat the treat on your command. Now think about that. The dog finds a treat but doesn't eat it until you give the command for it to eat. And when you practice this kind of game with your dog and make it more and more difficult, hiding the treat in a tuft of grass, for example, she said it really is a great thing to do. And I've known of people that have used the Kong balls. They'll put something inside the balls and throw them. You have to figure out what's going to work for you. But the animals love this kind of a game, and it sharpens their senses. Well, what's a treat that you might want to give your dog? Well, she came up with a recipe, and it employs rye flour, oatmeal, a potato, apple, ham, olive oil, and warm water. Let me give you the exact measurements on this. You need 3 1/3 cups of rye flour, 1 cup of fine oatmeal, a small apple. You want a medium-sized cooked potato, not raw, but cooked. 1/4 cup of smoked ham in cubes, and 1 2/3 tablespoons of olive oil, and approximately 1/2 cup of warm water. Now, your oven needs to be heated to 325 degrees. Get a baking pan, and you want to put parchment paper in the baking pan. You're going to take your rye flour, which you've measured, and your oatmeal. You know, mix that together. That takes you all of a second or two. And then your cooked potato, you cut it, and also the apple into cubes. And using an immersion blender, you puree with the sunflower. She calls it sunflower oil or olive oil and water. So you blend it, and then you mix it with a smoked ham and then all of the remaining ingredients. And it forms a very smooth dough. And you may need to add some water if it's a little bit on the dry side, because rye takes in a lot of water. And then you're going to roll the dough out to approximately 1/8 inch thick on a floured work surface, and then cut out the treats. You can make them in little squares, hearts. Dogs don't care. They don't care what it looks like. They want to know that it tastes good. And then you want to put your biscuits onto your baking pan and bake at 375. I misread it. It's 325. 325 for approximately 20 minutes. And if you like, you can keep the oven door open after you turn the oven off and just let the biscuits sit there, because the dogs love the crunch. They really do love the crunch. So this is something that you can really do well, and you need to let those biscuits dry out. Yes, they really need to dry. And then they last up to 6 weeks. They probably, depending on the size of your dog, might not last more than 2 weeks. But it's a great training tool, and you know that you're giving them good, nutritious food. This is very important. And I think dogs, just like people, need supplements. And this is where you need to research. You really need to check things out. And if you get to know a butcher, years ago, you could get to know your butcher. They'd save you scraps, and they wouldn't even charge you for it most of the time. Well, if you're like me, if you bought chicken liver and gizzards, well, it's over $3 a pound. And if your dog has a healthy appetite and is, you know, active, they're going to eat. So you have to realize that when you have a dog, your expenses are going to be going up, not down. That's right. It's just like having kids. They are a cost, a responsibility, but oh, the joy. The joy of having an animal in your life is just really very, very special. So anyway, I'm so delighted you've been able to be with me today. Remember always that you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. My guest Susan today is a woman that, though she was educated in so many ways and had a wonderful, wonderful aptitude for so many things, it wasn't until something pushed that passion button that she awakened to a life and to a world that today she is very much engaged in and that she loves dearly. Donna Sebo here. God bless, be well. Won't you join me tomorrow? We're going to be traveling to Atlantis. Are you curious? You should be. There's a lot to learn. Be well, be happy, stay sassy, and remember, life is a journey. Enjoy the process. I'll be talking to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.